Good morning. We have four cases on the calendar this morning. Case from the Court of Federal Claims relating to Indian Tribes, a case from the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, a Patent Office reexamination case, and a government employee case, which will be argued on the briefs and submitted on the briefs and not argued today. So, our first case is Council for Tribal Employment Rights versus the United States, 2014-5003. Mr. Press.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Daniel Press. I'm the attorney for Appellant Plaintiff Council for Tribal Employment Rights. While Appellant believes that the trial court erred in a number of its findings, I'm going to focus my bulk of my time today on the issue of whether the court erred in finding that the two contract amendments were void ab initio. And I'm focusing on that for two reasons. One is we believe the trial court failed to properly apply the standards and the principles that this court has established, the very high standards and principles this court has established for finding a case void ab initio.
Before you get to that, can I just ask you a sort of process question, which is what's your actual claim here for? Is it for, it's not for the full contract, I assume, but for the services you've already performed, is that right?
It's for the remainder of the contract. The two contract amendments, one was for $950,000. CTR was paid approximately $700,000 of that. It performed one set of training, which it was not paid for, and was staffed up to perform the second training, but was not.
Wait, so you were.
We're asking for the contract, repayment of the amount provided for in the contract.
For the full contract.
For the full contract.
Did you say that you got already? You got $700,000 out of the $900,000.
Yes. Yes.
So you received that money?
Yes, Your Honor.
So now you're looking for the difference.
Yeah, $200,000 on Contract Amendment 2 and $300,000 on Contract Amendment 6. So we're seeking basically full compliance with the contract.
But you didn't do all of the work for the contract.
Your Honor. We did part of the work that we weren't compensated for, but the client...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
you. Oh,
I'm
sorry.
You did part of the
we work did part of the work that we were not compensated for. But in addition, CTR was staffed up to complete the rest of the work. The agency refused to meet its obligations. The staff was still having to be paid while waiting for the agency to comply with, and as a result, the CTR was damaged the full amount of the contract. It had staffed up based on the amount of money in the contract, and it actually paid out that amount. So it's seeking the full amount of the contract damage. In the alternative, it's seeking the amount that for the work it actually performed but was not paid for.
Mr. Press, as I understand it, the provision 450BL, which requires that if there are multiple tribes involved, that each of the tribes provide consent. The reason for that provision, I understand, the basis for it, is to assure that the tribes will have the right of self-government preserved and protected. Is that fair? Is that a fair assessment?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Well, doesn't this then go right to the heart of that statute that here the individual tribes did not give their consent?
Your Honor, as we point out in our brief, in fact, no work was done on any reservation until the tribe provided CTR with a resolution consenting to the presence. The only difference is that instead of obtaining the contract amendment, the resolution at the time the contract amendments were executed, it obtained it after CTR entered in the subgrant agreement, but before it ever went on a reservation. So the full self-determination rights of the tribes were protected throughout this contract.
Was that a provision in the amendments?
Yes, Your Honor. The statement of work required that in the actual contract amendments, the state of work required that the subgrantee obtain contract tribal resolutions before it set foot on any reservation. So the contract protected the self-determination rights, but because it was CTR that was performing the actual work, the way it was structured, it was CTR that was to get the resolutions before it started work, rather than the tribe getting the resolutions before it executed the contract.
But isn't there a meaningful distinction between what the statute requires, which is a prerequisite for to the letting or making of such contract or grant, and what happened here, which you say it was done after the fact? Isn't that a significant distinction with regard to the principle we're trying to uphold, which is self-determination?
Your Honor, we consider that to be what I would call it's a distinction, but it's not a distinction that had any practical real-life impact. No tribe self-determination rights were violated. So even though there is a difference, the difference is purely one of timing, but the policy that Congress implemented was tribes should be able to control who comes on their reservation, and under this agreement, tribes had full control over who came on their reservation. The only difference was when it happened.
But how can we ignore the language of the statute, which is pretty clear? It says, in any case where a contract is let or grant made to an organization to perform services benefiting more than one Indian tribe, the approval of each such Indian tribe shall be a prerequisite to the letting or making of such contract or grant.
Your Honor, we're not asking you to ignore that, but what the argument I'm raising is whether the court was correct in finding the contracts to be void ab initio, and to do that, it has to find one that was obvious and two that it was substantial. And substantial, based on the cases from this court, says there actually has to be a real-life impact, and there was no real-life impact. Secondly, the court says the violation has to be obvious. In this case, as the trial court found, the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Office of Indian Economic Development, the two cognizant agencies for the Self-Determination Act, had a long-standing customary practice of not requiring resolutions on self-determination contracts that serve multiple tribes. So what CTR did in this case was simply follow a long-standing customary practice of the agency. So we don't believe it was obvious to CTR. If you had asked any official of the BIA or IAD at any point in 2009 or before that, is there a requirement that you obtain resolutions on this kind of contract, every one of them would have said no, because that was the practice of the agency. I can't tell you how they reached that conclusion. In our brief, we lay out why we think 450BL doesn't apply to multi-tribal contracts. But the real question is, was this obvious, and was it substantial? And when a contractor, not even a contract in this case, a subgrantee, who wasn't present when the contract was negotiated, when a subgrantee simply follows a long-standing customary practice of an agency, we believe it's inappropriate to find that to be an obvious, which this court has decided, has interpreted as being, did the contractor, was the violation?
Is your view based on the fact that you think there's some ambiguity in the contract, in the statutory language, or you think it's irrelevant? I mean, let's assume there was something, you know.
I'm sorry.
The contract, the statutory language is clear, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But.
And do you reach the fact that it was non-obvious because you think there's ambiguity of the statute, or you think the provision is kind of inconsequential and therefore it should not have been obvious to you, or what?
No, it wasn't obvious to CTR because the cognizant agencies that Congress designated for interpreting this statute had concluded that it didn't apply to multiple contracts involving multiple tribes. That was a finding of the court. CTR was following the lead of the cognizant agencies in their interpretation of the 450BL.
Well, that, when you say their interpretation, that wasn't via regulations or rulings or anything like that, right? That was just done on a case that you're saying it was their interpretation. That's based on the fact that what they had done a few previous contracts?
It was a customary practice, and the agency did that for years. Nobody ever challenged it. Nobody ever questioned it. And that's why IED did it in this case. It had done it before in many, many other circumstances. Were they correct in their interpretation of the statute? We haven't found anything to explain why they concluded it wasn't obvious, but that was their practice. And while clearly your conclusion it was a deviation from the statute may be correct, the standard is, was it obvious? And our view is that a subgrantee should not be held responsible for challenging the interpretation of a statute by the cognizant agencies. It was not palpably illegal in CTR's eyes because they were following the lead of the cognizant agencies.
We can save the rest of your time if you like.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Or you can use it.
I just want to raise a couple of questions about the obvious. Again, CTR was not the contractor, and there's never been a case holding that a subgrantee or a subcontractor was required to not only know but influence the way a contract was issued.
There's always a first time.
Yes, Your Honor. We hope this will not be it. But also the language that this court has used is palpably illegal in the eyes of the contractor. And that's pretty strong language. Palpably means self-evident. It almost implies that the contractor knew what was going on and intended to somehow avoid the statute. That was not the case here. Again, CTR was a subgrantee and it was following the lead of the cognizant agencies. Secondly, the court has said that the deviation has to be substantial, and it's used the word egregious. And that, again, like palpable, is a very strong word. And we believe this was not egregious because no harm was done. The self-determination policies were fully complied with. The tribes had the ability to say who would come on the reservation, who would not. The difference was timing. Finally, this court has set out three principles for determining when a court should find a case to be void ab initio. First, it should not find it to be void ab initio, or it disfavors finding it void ab initio when the contract has been substantially performed. And as I indicated, one contract was 90% performed, the second was 50% performed. Secondly, it particularly disfavors finding void ab initio when the contractor has no other avenue of relief. And in this case, the trial court shut out every avenue of relief that was contained in our complaint. As a result, CTR will never see the money for the work it actually performed or for the remainder of the contract money that it had been promised. So this is a case that this court has said it strongly disfavors. Finally, the court says that in close cases, the benefit of the doubt should be given to the contractor. And as I indicated, in some ways this is a unique case because the contractor is not the party at the table. It's a subcontractor who wasn't involved in the negotiations. In fact, CTR never received a copy of the contract until this case was filed and we were able to obtain it through discovery. So CTR had no idea what was in the contract. So in some ways, it seems unfair to hold CTR responsible for a contract that it had never seen and when it was simply following the lead of the two cognizant agencies that had followed this practice over a period of time. So for those reasons, we ask that the court reverse the trial court's conclusion that this case was void ab initio. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Press. We'll save a minute for you for rebuttal. Mr. Ashman.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, the trial court's decision should be affirmed because the agreements at issue in this case violated a clear statutory prerequisite for the issuance of agreements under the Indian Self-Determination Act, and that violation was plain and substantial.
Mr. Ashman, these contracts were, these amendments were at least performed in part, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What precipitated the government's change of position?
The issue with the statute, the violation of the statute, was identified after litigation began. There was a dispute, general disputes that arose between the parties while the contracts were ongoing that led to the claim, that led to the lawsuit. But then it was in response, in developing our response to the lawsuit, that we identified that, yes, there was a clear violation of the statute in the formation of these agreements.
So otherwise, the government had already paid a substantial portion of the contract, right? And this is the remaining part, and you were disputing it with the contractor for reasons other than the issues that are before us now?
Essentially, Your Honor, yes. As alleged in the complaint, under Amendment Number 2 of the nine tribes that received training, eight training services were provided, and there's a dispute over payment for one. These other seven were paid. And from Amendment Number 2, which had a total value of $500,000, as alleged in the contract, there was an initial payment of $200,000 that was received by the tribe, but then none of the tribes under Amendment 2, no services or training was actually afforded to the tribes under Amendment Number 2. So there was...
You're responding to the argument that the contracts have been substantially performed. Your answer is they've been substantially paid.
There has been a substantial payment, Your Honor, and I believe the majority of the damages at issue in the complaint are consequential-type damages flowing from the breach, delay, standby, you know, typical delay contractor delay-type claims. There is one claim for outstanding services that had not been paid.
Doesn't that hurt your argument? I mean, your friend says the standard is obvious, and it couldn't have been obvious to anyone because the government had proceeded forever in not applying the statutory provision or reapplying it in a way other than explicitly states. And you're standing before us and telling us, yeah, I guess that's right, because nobody even woke up to the statutory provision until the suit was filed.
Your Honor, we acknowledge that this provision had not been enforced for whatever reason by the agency. However, we believe the standard for whether or not it is plain starts with the statute. It was the violation clear in reference to the statute. So the first issue, the first argument that's been raised is it ambiguous? Is that statutory language ambiguous? And we believe if the court concludes, as the trial court did, no, it is not ambiguous. If you read that, you know the requirement. And if the court comes to that conclusion that it was not ambiguous, that a reasonable contractor, government official, anyone reading that statute would know this is a requirement that had to be followed, then the standard of was the violation plain, we believe that's met.
Well, now that the government has figured it out, is this the standard which is being applied currently to contracts? Now, I mean, is it something that somebody finally figured out or noticed there was a statutory provision and perhaps their practice had been violating that for years? Has that now been applied below?
Your Honor, when this issue was identified in this case, it sparked a reevaluation of the contracting procedures at the agency. And as the trial court pointed out, I believe footnote 13, that then director of IED acknowledged that going forward that these trial resolutions had to be obtained before the contract was issued. Subsequently, there has not yet been any formal guidance or regulation expanding on the issue at this case, but it has caused a change in course of the agency. If we
affirm the ruling that amendments were void ab initio, does the government intend to seek a refund of monies paid?
No, Your Honor, we brought no affirmative claim in this case. We've raised this issue as a defense to the claims that were brought against the government. We have not sought replenishment or replevin of any funds that have been paid to either the tribe or CTR in this case. So we have no affirmative claim in that regard.
Are there any claims pending in court below or potential claims that involve the same position that you know of?
Not related to this contract, Your Honor, and not related. We know no other claims that have been brought since the government has identified this issue, seeking some sort of challenging the validity of any other contracts that have been issued prior to 2009 based on this. Your Honor, one point I believe that has come up is the idea, was there a tangible harm? And the issue of the timing of when these resolutions were required to get. And we believe that there is a tangible harm. The purpose of the self-determination statute was to change the dynamic between the government and the Indians, to change the way the government, the relationship, to make it more of a commercial-type relationship, more of an arm's-length-type relationship, to promote self-determination and promote self-sufficiency among the Indian tribes. So, and we believe that this not following the tribal resolution requirement as a prerequisite changes that relationship of providing the tribe the right of prior approval, the right to control the not just who enters its jurisdiction, but the contracting process itself. So, for example, if the government enters into a contract with a tribal organization to provide services, and the tribal organization is then to go out and identify tribes to give those services to, when the organization goes to that tribe, it says, okay, we have a contract, we have these services. If you want them, you have to go by these terms. These are the terms. Take it or leave it. So we believe that the dynamic of the relationship has fundamentally changed.
With respect to Amendment 6, as I understand it, what you just described was about to contemplated that the contracting party would then go out, identify various tribes, and that those tribes would then receive some funding through this program. But at the time the contract, the amendment was entered into, those tribes were not known, correct?
Yes, yes, Your Honor.
How could they possibly have signed the amendment?
Your Honor, the first question we would ask is the contemplated contract within the class of agreements that this statute was meant to cover. And Amendment 2, or Amendment 6, even though the tribes themselves were not identified, it was a contract to provide services for more than one tribe. So the statute clearly applies. And we believe the trial court got it correct that, because the parties chose to craft an agreement that would otherwise be directly within the purview of the statute, because they chose to craft it in a way that created compliance impossible, that's not a way of relieving the obligation.
So perhaps the amendment had to have built into it some sort of a clause that said, as a condition precedent to the actual funding, the tribe shall first be identified and signed, or some such thing.
That could very well have been a way to remedy the situation that was created, Your Honor. And finally, we just want to bring the issue of the awarding official authority. We want to bring one issue to the court's attention. There was an issue about the trial court noted that the limitation on the awarding official's authority may not have been readily apparent in violation of a FAR statute. There is a statute that we unfortunately did not raise in our brief that we want to bring to the court's attention, and that's section of that 25 U.S.C. section 450J. Says that the federal acquisition statutes and regulations do not apply to self-determination agreements. So we wanted to bring that statute to the court's attention.
Counsel, better late than never, but it is a bit late to be citing a statute as an important factor in our determination at oral argument.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Your Honor, unless there's any other questions, for these reasons, we respectfully request that the court affirm the trial court's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Ashton.
Just as an aside, I would just mention that your brief, did you write the brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
The brief was replete with acronyms, and I would encourage and suggest that next time you not use acronyms. Very difficult to follow. It would be much easier to use a short name rather than an acronym.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Press, you used the bulk of your time, but you have a minute to reply.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two quick points. One is in regard to Amendment 6, and the fact it did contain that condition precedent. CTR was not allowed to, once the tribes were identified, it could not start work on those tribes' reservation until it got a resolution. So it met the criteria you set out.
Where would I find that?
It's in the scope of work to the contract, which is Attachment A, I believe. And I think we saw
definition of terms, Section A.
I don't have the contract in front of me, but it's the scope of work to Contract Amendment 6. And I think we referred to it several times in our brief.
Okay.
Secondly, just while the court has been saying, and Pelley's been saying that this was self-evident, the cognizant agencies that Congress assigned to interpret this act did not think it was self-evident. We never had a chance to depose them because the Pelley did not raise this issue until very, very late in the case in its reply brief to the motion to dismiss. But we believe that some credence has to be given to the fact that the cognizant agencies did not see this to be as obvious as Pelley is implying.
Thank you, Mr. Press. The case will be taken under advisement.